playing the New Zealand rock band The Found on Take It From Us as our theme tune for our mental health radio program. They're a trio of Kiwi musicians, two of whom are mental health consumers. Let's listen to some more of their track, Long Gone. Today on Take It From Us, we interview mental health personality Mary O'Hagan, who now describes herself as a consultant, writer and speaker. Constantly in demand to be a keynote speaker at mental health events, Mary O'Hagan was a former commissioner at the Mental Health Commission. She's had personal experience of the big bins, as she describes them, of the past, and has a high profile in mental health circles. Take It From Us interviewed Mary O'Hagan at her Wellington home earlier this month. Here is the interview. So, Mary, welcome to Take It From Us. It's great to have you on the show, and we have met at past Like Minds conferences. So what has Mary O'Hagan been doing over the past 12 months?
Well, I left the commission in 2007, so I've been out of there for about years now, and I've set myself up as a self-employed person.
Yeah,
and most of my work actually is overseas, and I've done quite a lot of work in Canada and in Britain and some in the Netherlands.
So that requires quite a bit of travelling then, does it?
Yes, it has done. Probably about two or three trips a year. I mean, a lot of the work I do can be done from my office in Wellington, fortunately.
Yeah. So you're becoming an international mental health consultant.
Well, yes, it's a big world out there, and New Zealand's quite small. And, I think we've got a population of 4 million people. You go to places like Britain, they have much bigger populations, and the work opportunities are much greater.
So have you found that your profile has sort of gone ahead of you, or...?
Yes. I mean, I think I had I've had a profile in other countries, which has really helped me get work. I think it would have been difficult without that.
And what sort of projects have you been undertaking in places like Canada and the UK?
Well, one thing we're doing in Canada is that we're doing a project for the Canadian Mental Health Commission, looking at doing a lot of consultation with people who are involved in peer support projects across the whole of Canada. And we're going to be reporting back to the Commission with recommendations on how the provincial governments in Canada can support the development of peer support.
So is peer support as far advanced as it is in New Zealand, or further advanced in places like Canada?
Well, it seems to be very advanced. Talking about advanced, I mean, there's more of it in Ontario than other provinces. But, you know, we're still talking about a tiny percentage of the whole mental health budget going into peer support. As you are in any country. I mean, we calculated at the Commission that probably about a half of a percent of the total mental health budget went into consumer-run initiatives. And I know that probably about, you know, it was about a 1% of the money went into consumer-run initiatives in Ontario as well. So when you say there's a lot, well... it depends what measure you're using, really. But certainly there's more development in Ontario than elsewhere.
those sort of percentages aren't ones that would please a consumer champion like you.
Oh, they certainly don't. No, they don't please me. You know, there's been a lot of stalling going on in New Zealand with the creation of a new peer support workforce and new peer support services. They're happening, but they're happening without adequate planning and funding and without an adequate vision of where mental health services need to go.
I guess it would be my impression that peer support is the thing that is being talked about more than perhaps anything else in New Zealand. It does appear to be the growth area, yet you're saying that only, what, 0.5% of 1% is being spent on that area.
Well, what I'm talking about is consumer-run initiatives, a lot of which do peer support. There are peer support services inside NGOs that aren't run by consumers and within DHBs. So that, I'm sure the percentage is slightly higher, but it would be something very small still. And it's good to see that there's a lot of talk about peer support. And some people predict that this will be the biggest growing workforce and type of service over the next generation. And this is not just in New Zealand, but in other Western countries as well. But so far, we don't see the money going where the talk is. And that's a slight concern for me. And I think we can't forget that there are a lot of vested interests in any system. There's a lot of money tied up in acute inpatient services and in clinical type services. It's a very hard, slow job to kind of reorient the funding in another way.
How much pressure do you think is coming from the sort of pharmaceutical sector in terms of what you're saying there?
Well, I think the drug companies have got a very low profile in New Zealand, and they particularly have since Pharmac came. But they have had a huge influence on the development of psychiatry internationally. And I think they've had a very, while I think that drugs can be beneficial for people, and they can also do terrific harm, but the drug companies have steered psychiatry into a biological cul-de-sac, I think, and I think that we've got to get out of this cul-de-sac. Otherwise, we're not going to get proper peer support services. We're not going to get the kinds of things that allow people the social and material and personal opportunities they've lost through developing mental health problems and being in the mental health system.
So perhaps just by coincidence in me mentioning pharmaceutical companies, there is a conflict here between the concept of peer support and what the pharmaceutical companies are doing. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't think there's a conflict between taking drugs and doing peer support, because my approach is that, look, people need to find what works for them. But the problem is the mental health system doesn't give a menu of all the things that might work for people. And in my day, really, it was the pills and pillows. That was all that we were given was medication and hospital. Now, the mental health system's a bit better at that now. I mean, there is a broader range of services, but when you talk to people or read research about people's recovery experiences and think about your own, mental health services aren't looking at that stuff and saying, well, we need to respond to these things that people say work. They're responding to well, they're not, they're just advancing a status quo, which was really, you know, driven by a psychiatric profession that started in the asylum era and has been captured by the profit-making interests of the drug companies.
So there's an overemphasis on the medication. That's the sort of quick fix.
Well, I think that, you know, if you look at what people need, and then you look at the funding, the way funding is used to slice up in mental health services, you have a huge amount going into clinical services. Mm. And when you talk to people about, well, what helped in their recovery, well, you know, some people say medication was somewhat important, but gosh, there are a lot of other things that needed to happen or I needed to do. And yet, like getting a house and getting a partner and finding a job and finding the self-respect again and knowing how to deal with the you know, the ups and downs that come with life. And yet, you don't see that reflected in the way the funding in mental health services is sliced up.
So do you see peer support as a way of coming out of this, what you describe as a biological cul-de-sac?
I think peer support, and that's a very broad term, really, and I would include one of my little hobby horses, recovery learning or recovery education in that. But I think that, you know, what my vision is for the future is you see, what's happened in the last, you know, couple of hundred years is that communities have increasingly abdicated responsibility for people in trouble to experts who and institutions. Now, that may have had some good impact because communities weren't always that nice to people who are in trouble or people who are different. But now we're suffering from the effects of, you know, authorities and experts having a monopoly of power and knowledge about how to fix people up. When really, what peer support does is says, well, you know, we have the power within ourselves to kind of be the architects of our own recovery, and we'll use whatever supports or treatments we think work. And I think that's a big turnaround from, you know, the old sort of expert who's the authority to us being an authority in our own recovery, and the experts are really just there to give advice on particular issues.
I'm very interested in your concept of community and perhaps how that is broken down, because clearly it's quite hard to secure a community in a city like Auckland or probably any city. How does peer support help to develop community, do you think?
Well, I mean, I just think of my own life and the peer support that we had when we were starting up psychiatric survivors in Auckland. And, I mean, I was a recipient of that as much as anyone else. I mean, even though I was a paid organiser, I guess. And, you know, I think there was a strong community that was developed out of that. And the only issue with that I have is that we don't want to create ghettos either. See, what the mental health system has created ghettos. I mean, they had these well-defined ghettos in the old institutions, and now we've just got these small little ghettos dotted around the community. Yeah. And I wouldn't like peer support to go that way either, even though I think that it's a great thing to be in the company of peers who really understand your experience. Most people want to go out and be part of a wider community as well.
Okay, Mary, well, let's take a break from the interview and take a little bit of heat off you. Your choice was to play some Mahinarangi Toka, and we've got a track from Mahinarangi called Tender. Identified a real difficulty in that even with Mental Health Awareness Week, you know, we tend to preach to our own people with lived experience and run music gigs for people with lived experience without going out into the mainstream and preaching the message there.
Well, you know, I think community attitudes are changing, and you know, programs like the Like Minds program, I think, have helped with that a bit. But, you know, I think back to community attitudes when I started this work over 20 years ago, and I think they're getting better. And this gets on to my views about madness, which I think you wanted to talk about.
Right.
You see, I think both in wider society, within the mental health system, and within our own selves, you know, being people who have had mental health problems, I don't think we're going to get any profound change until we start having a different attitude towards madness.
And what do you really mean there, that you've got to come out of the closet and reclaim the language? And
That's a part of it. I mean, that's why I use the word. It's a reclaimed word. And that's why some people use the word nutter. But really, what I'm talking about is something a bit deeper than just the words you use. It's about seeing madness as a full human experience and not as something that has to be feared or pitied. Now, I'm not suggesting that it's a nice experience or that we should romanticise it, because I think for a lot of people it's very distressing. But what's happened to madness over the centuries in our own culture and in many other cultures is that people have relegated it to the sort of bottom of the pile of human experience. And they've said, you know, these people, they're not in their right minds, they don't know what they're thinking, and there's no sort of sense, you know, it's just relegated into the margins. And, you know, there are plenty of examples of this with other groups. I mean, people felt that, you know, the debate about slavery in America was littered with comments that the people who are slaves were not full human beings, therefore we don't have to give them the consideration or the respect or the rights that they deserve. Again, you know, with the disenfranchisement of women, I remember there was a report of a parliamentarian in New Zealand when they were debating the women's vote, saying, well, women's brains are 5 ounces lighter than men's, and they just don't have the brain power to be able to vote. So there are plenty of examples of other marginalised groups who were not given full human status.
And yet there are so many brilliant people who were also regarded as mad. And perhaps we need to promote those brilliant people more regularly.
Well, I think we do need to promote them, but that's just part of a strategy to get a sea change in the way people think about madness. And to do something as deep as that in the community's consciousness and in the consciousness of professionals and even ourselves, I mean, that's the thing that takes a long time and is a multi-level thing. And in fact, it's something we don't have a lot of control over, actually. But, I mean, you know, highlighting the lives of mad people who've been successful or done great things is one strategy for doing that, yeah.
What other strategies are part of your vision for this?
Well, I think there's probably hundreds of them, but one is getting the voices of people who've experienced madness into the media discourse, into literature, into the academic discourse, into research, into all those kind of conversations that go on in society, because we've been completely excluded from them. Really, I mean, even in the literary tradition, there's a long tradition of people who've experienced madness writing their own, autobiographies, but we're really until the middle of the 20th century, no one was really interested in them, you know. So I think our voices have got to get heard, and I think that's a very, very major strategy.
And to have our voices heard, we need to be credible and, do we need to be credible and recovered, do you think?
Not necessarily, no. Because I think underlying what I'm saying is that we need a community that is accepting of diversity, and so if we try and normalise our behaviour too much, then we're fitting into a mould of a community that's not accepting of diversity. So I wouldn't go down that track too much, although I think learning how to come across as credible in a political sense is quite a wise thing to do sometimes.
Well, probably in a media sense as well.
I think there are complexities about that need a bit of exploration.
Well, there's an opportunity with Radio Live, in fact, on a Sunday evening. They have started off with Mike King last Sunday with what is called the Nutters Club. And David Kadire, who is the Clinical Director of Psychological Services at ProCare, is, if you like, the authority. But they're going to have others in the studio, and they're inviting callers to call in with their own experiences.
I think it's great. Yeah, I think it's really great. And I didn't know about that, but I mean, I think that kind of thing. Now, has Mike King had his own experiences?
Absolutely, yes.
Yeah, I thought he had. So I think that's a fantastic thing to do.
Yeah, well, it's come out of the blue campaign, which is really the Depression campaign, funded by Movember and sort of hosted, if you like, by the Mental Health Foundation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, David Kadia is, you know, one of the psychiatrists who I think is doing a really good job. You know, and I think people like him need to be held up as a good example to some of his colleagues who are perhaps more caught in the biological cul-de-sac.
Yeah, I want to ask you about your definition of the biological cul-de-sac.
Well, actually, I only came up with the term as I was talking to you, so...
well, it's a beauty. They make a great headline.
I think what I mean is that a biological cul-de-sac is just... a mindset that doesn't look down any other pathways to explore what the determinants, the treatments, the supports, or the consequences of madness can be. Now, I'm not suggesting that psychiatrists are personally caught up in it, but they're working in a system that drives them into that cul-de-sac all the time.
It's
a very clinically based system.
Well, that
doesn't give people an opportunity to explore other approaches very much.
Isn't the problem that, you know, you've only got 15 minutes or 30 minutes with your psychiatrist and what sort of solutions can they come up with in that sort of time?
Well, that's true, and psychiatrists are too expensive, you see, so we can't have them for very long. But I think one of the problems is that they still hold... I mean, I know that they do feel powerless a lot since these new management professionals came in 15 or 20 years ago, but I think they still hold a lot of power at the clinical level. And I think that there's a lack of imagination and courage among some of them, and I think they just get, I think they do get stuck in this cul-de-sac.
One of the interviews that I undertook reasonably recently was with a Dr. Scott Miller, who was out here doing some workshops. And, you know, he stressed that there was a need to have a conversation with your psychiatrist to see whether, you know, you were going to have empathy together and also to understand, I guess, what the approach was that the psychiatrist was going to take. You know, and so there was sort of an understanding, but I guess most of the time we're referred to somebody as a specialist and we just go along quite meekly and think, well, this is where I'm supposed to be.
Well, absolutely, and, you know, like, you should really interview your psychiatrist when you first go to them. But unfortunately, you know, when we first go to a psychiatrist, we often feel so lousy that we're not really in a, you know, we may not feel up to being that assertive, or unless, you know, we're high or something. So I think I think that's part of the whole recovery thing, is about taking an active role in your own recovery and not just sitting there waiting for these so-called experts to fix you up, because they can't.
Well,
But, you know, when I was using services a lot, I tried to interview my psychiatrist about what he believed, and he couldn't deal with it.
Mm.
You know, I said, well, look, what do you think of a well-functioning human being? Because he wanted to do some psychotherapy with me. And I said, I need to know what you think a well-functioning human being is, because how can we talk about me if we don't have the same views about these sorts of things? And he just couldn't deal with it. And he did the standard traditional psychiatric thing and asked me a question aimed at unveiling my own pathology.
Well, I guess you were claiming a little control in the whole relationship, and maybe that person wasn't comfortable with that.
No, and they weren't, and they did say I had control issues in that same conversation.
Well, you're doing very well.
Very ironical, but anyway.
You're doing very well in this interview.
Controlling it.
No, I was thinking quite the opposite. That you're talking in very good sound bites and short responses.
Ah, right, yes.
So we're going to play a second track from the Mahinarangi Toka Hey Ha CD, which is called To Beat With Her Heart.
Tahi Rua Toru Fa. She could have been a dancer or a breaker of waves, but she chose to be living a lie of the heart. She could have been a painter, colored forget-me-not, but she chose to be living, to lie by the heart. Now she is waiting, waiting for someone, waiting. Oh, she is waiting for somebody to kiss her better, waiting for somebody to come. She could have been happy or braver or bold, but she chose to stop trying to beat with her heart, to beat with her heart. Now she is waiting, waiting for someone, waiting. She is waiting for somebody to kiss her better, waiting for somebody to come. Oh, she dares to be caring of the sins that she never sins, or the guilt she wants to dress up in a London now. All unpinned, waiting. Waiting. Waiting for somebody to kiss her better. Waiting for somebody to come. Somebody to be admired, but she left it much too late to be with her heart, to be with her heart. Won't somebody listen up? Won't somebody care? She is. For someone, she is waiting. She is waiting for somebody to kiss her better, waiting for somebody to come. Could have been a dancer, and she could have been a painter, and she could have been braver.
Just to go back to your strong advocacy for reclaiming the language of madness, I guess my view is that that can almost accentuate the discrimination against people that have lived experience. What's your view of that?
I can see why people think that. And my view is that sometimes you have to sort of, when you're in a movement for change, you need to say things that jolt people a bit. Now, not everyone's going to be comfortable saying those things, and I respect that. Then not all my peers in the movement want to go around saying madness and nutter. And, you know, that's just a personal choice. But I think if you look at the history of, you know, the progress of other movements, and you think how, you know, gay people sort of said queer and, you know, black people in America call themselves niggers and things like that, I think it's quite a nice little trick, because what it does is it takes the word off the people who are discriminating against you.
Mm.
It takes it off them. You repossess it and you give it a twist with your own particular meaning.
I mean, last Sunday was the first time that I realised that Mike King had called this to our talkback session